So can we confidently say that Timothée Chalamet is now officially a bro? Is this man a bro? Is he no longer the dying Victorian child that we're used to? Is he full
listen,
on bro?
Listen, Nick, I hate to interrupt, but welcome to Hate to Interrupt. I am Ethan from youtube.com/Gulif, and I am joined by
Nick from Stop Culture.
I'm VHS guy Nick.
Yeah, and so today we're joined by Kayla Says. Kayla from Kayla Says. How are you doing, Kayla?
Good. Thank you guys so much for having me on. I'm excited to chat with you all.
Yeah, thanks, of course.
Yeah, thanks for giving our little potentially scam-looking channel a chance. Because I don't know. I feel like I'd be a little worried if I had a 50-sub count podcast. Be like, hey!
You would be surprised at, I think, like, because I have a business email, the one that you guys, you know, reached out to, and we get a lot of wild people trying to, like, pretend to be legitimate. So it's actually, like, very rare and easy to spot legitimate podcast inquiries. And I was very excited when I got this one, because I was like, oh my god, it's not, like, some random person from Thailand trying to impersonate the Hershey's chocolate company, you know?
Jesus.
This is very thrilling for me, yeah.
So those are the kinds of things you have to sift through when you're big enough to have sponsors. You gotta get fake Hershey's Kisses people coming at you. That sucks.
Fake Hershey's Kisses. I've gotten like any like major like company that has like stock trading options, you would be surprised at the amount of people from across the world who will try and fail to impersonate them in order to try to harvest your information.
Oh my
Jesus.
God.
Jesus. Yeah, I'd probably just ignore 90% of emails.
I'd be terrified.
That's what we
anything.
Have to look forward to, guys. If we ever start growing on YouTube, we have to deal with that stuff. That sounds like a nightmare. But
it's gonna be great.
But today we're going to be interviewing Kayla about, you know, her process, her journey on YouTube. And then she recommended a really great movie for us to talk about too, Raising Arizona, which is one of the first Coen brother films. It's directed by Joel, right? And Ethan wrote it together, and then Ethan produced. So it's not it's different than their workflow became eventually, you know what I mean? Great movie nonetheless. So, but yeah, just to, you know, start the interview off, I just wanted to ask you, like, so just like thinking back to when you were first starting your channel, like, what were your goals on YouTube initially, and how did those contrast with the goals you have now that your channel is bigger and you've been doing it for a while?
Yeah. So I first got started on YouTube in 2020, and that's 5 years ago now. And that is crazy to me that is so long ago. And basically, the way that I got into it was like, first of all, I always felt like I was like, and you guys probably are too, like, you know, children of the internet, in the sense that YouTube was probably a big kind of formative experience for you, and you grew up watching different YouTubers that kind of influence what you do now. And so I definitely had that experience. And in 2020, I graduated college, but I graduated like into the pandemic. So there were like no jobs for anyone.
Yeah.
So I was like at home in my parents' house, and I was like, what am I going to do with myself? And I was like, okay, well, I have all this time now. If I don't try it now, I'm never going to do it. And so I made just like a couple videos. I made them kind of, I think, in the style of people that I really liked and people that I watched a lot. And so I just tried to imitate like, you know, I started out doing more like, I don't know, retrospectives on stuff, like Defunct Land was a big kind of inspo for me, YMS, Lindsay Ellis, and I tried to kind of imitate those people until eventually I think I found my own sort of style and like what makes me different. And so over the last 5 years, I've kind of just like adapted that and tried to really hone in on like what people know me for. I have a journalism background, so I try to like employ that kind of into what I do and how I break down certain topics. And that's my goal now, is just to make like, you know, comprehensive, informative content. I think content that's like empathetic and helps people understand things. And I just try to get better at that the more that I do it.
That's awesome. That's really interesting that you said you had a journalistic background, because that's definitely something that I get from your videos. Like, you definitely have a thirst to like try to make the topic you're covering seem exhaustive. Like, you're covering all the nooks and crannies of every little issue that you're covering, which is really cool.
Yeah, it's You go, sorry.
No, it's also very interesting. You brought up how you started your channel in 2020. I think that's probably true for like a big chunk of YouTubers right now. So many of them, you know, you get that spot where you're like, well, I got free time. I got a lot of free time. So I'm going to start a YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. I think there's a few of them that have kind of popped up in that space. And that's really interesting.
Yeah,
a lot of people definitely cropped up kind of in that era, I think, just because, it was like, at this point, like, if you're not, when are you ever going to have this much, like, time to just, like, try to actually, like, and, you know, everybody was online. It was the other thing. It was like, you know, that was the most online people have been in a while. So it was like, that lent itself, I think, to, like, getting all these new people kind of getting discovered around that time.
So, like, initially, was it like just a fun thing, basically? Did you have aspirations of ever making it into what it is now? Is this like just totally, you know, did it just happen out of nowhere for you, or was this the goal always?
I always had the idea that, like, you know, because when you're starting out, it is like the most demoralizing grind where you're like, I don't know why I'm doing this. This is so cringe. Like, I need to, like, go bury my head in the sand and, like, not tell anybody that I'm doing this at all. And I always had this feeling that I was like, I just need one to, like, hit big in the algorithm, and I need to get some people coming back. And I feel like if just, like, I get that chance, like, I'm gonna rock with it and be able to turn it into something, you know, greater. And that did happen. And I will not lie, it's a lot of luck, a lot of kind of just, you know, random gambles sort of play into it. It did, as like corny as it sounds, I think it did change like the trajectory of my life, because like, at the time that I was unemployed when I started, I have a journalism background again. So like, I worked a lot in broadcast newsrooms, and that was my job throughout like the five or so years that I was like really doing YouTube as like a side gig. And so eventually it got to the point where it was like, I kind of felt fulfilled in that world. And I realized like the kind of power that new media like YouTube and content creators can have doing the same sort of work. And that helped me like kind of move out of the broadcast industry. And now I work in marketing as like my full-time job. But like, this became, I basically have two jobs. Like, I do the marketing stuff as like my, you know, that's what gives me my 401k and my health benefits. But like, this is also a sizable chunk of my income. And it, you know, it has opened doors for me that I like definitely didn't expect.
That's, I see, like, it's, I feel like it's kind of maybe bad etiquette to be like, so do you do this full time? But I definitely was curious. I mean, you definitely, it seems you post every week, right? That's mm-hmm. pretty religiously, and you have, you know, you get a sizable amount of views on every video you post. So I feel like for me personally, like the money you're bringing in, that would be a full-time income for me probably, because I'm just used to not making a lot of money. Like, you know.
Yeah, so, it's sorry, you go, sorry.
Well, we've talked about this a lot, but like a lot of us kind of have our own sort of like aspirations that are kind of driven through YouTube. Like maybe, like obviously we like doing YouTube and it's something we enjoy doing, but a lot of us kind of want to do something bigger, I guess, right? So like, mm-hmm. do you have some kind of like end goal with your channel where like maybe you bring on a bigger team to like be able to touch on more topics, or is there any kind of like goal that you have for yourself in the future?
Yeah, for sure. So I actually, like, before I got into, like, journalism as, like, my career, I was really into film, and I wanted to be a screenwriter, and it's, like, something that I sort of, like, abandoned, because I was like, I'm not gonna make any money doing this. And so, you know, as I kind of get, like, more, I guess, known online, I want to eventually like be able to hopefully springboard that into like trying to actually like pursue my more creative projects that I like abandoned long ago in the pursuit of like grinding within the capitalist hellscape, right? I think just having that kind of like I guess name recognition like in the internet world, it does help you, you know. So I would like to parlay kind of into that eventually. People ask me this all the time in terms of like my channel and like, you know, how it's going to grow. I pretty much am like, and this is not common for people kind of at my size, just from, you know, the people that I've talked to. I do it all myself. So like, I write, I edit, I host, I record. The only person that helps me really is my partner, Brian, who is in videos occasionally. Like, he'll help me do stuff that, like, because he has kind of a similar background that, like, I don't have as much experience in, but, like, it's kind of all me. And then also I have, like, a in my business email, like, Spark Media LA, like, they handle my ads and stuff like that. But other than that, like, it's, like, very much a one-person operation, and I don't know if I, like, I'm such a control freak that I don't know if I ever see myself, like, escaping out of that mentality, but every YouTuber my size and bigger who I've talked to is like, you need to hire an editor, and I'm like, one day,
yeah,
maybe.
Personally for me, it's like, editing is such an expressive way of turning a video, you know, because you write your scripts, you record everything, but that, you know, the video truly comes into itself with the edit, so I can't imagine giving that to someone else, you know, at this point at least. You know, I'm way too small to be able to fully invest in something like that, but that's such a big part of video creating for me that I can totally see myself not doing.
So I was just thinking, I was like, I could totally hand that part off. That's my next question for you. It's like, you know, we're all YouTubers here. We know there's a lot of really fun aspects of being a YouTuber and, you know, creating content and everything, but there's also just a lot of really annoying, time consuming grunt work that, you know, just to conceive the video, first of all, because you need to, especially for you, you need to be like researching things and always being, you know, have your finger on the pulse of whatever's going on. So like, that being said, what's your least favorite aspect of content creation as a whole, like the process of it?
Oh my god. It's recently, honestly, and I probably shouldn't say this, but it's like so real. Because I deal with sponsors, and it's such like a big, like, it takes up a lot of time, just because like you have to like kind of work with the confines of like what these companies kind of want you to do. And like, you know, you have to do it on their timeline. Sometimes they're not as responsive as you like them to be. Creating the ads are time consuming. Figuring out which videos they're going to go into is time consuming. Thankfully, at the very least, like I have a management team that like deals with the negotiating for that. Cause I used to have to do that myself. And that was a nightmare. Talking like money, like, you know, like Ridge or like HelloFresh is like my own personal hell on earth. And so I'm glad at the very least I don't have to do that part of it. But like, it's so businessy and like it involves like spreadsheets and live dates and timelines and things that like, if you're a creative, you don't really want to deal with. So I'd say it's a lot of that. And then also like being a pop culture YouTuber, it's kind of like, I get stressed because I'm just like, once you get kind of like that pattern of like all these kind of big view videos, you want to try to replicate that success over and over again. And sometimes it's just not going to happen. And yeah, like, it feels like the most devastating thing in the world when it doesn't happen. But a lot of it is just trying to like figure out like a happy medium between what my audience wants to see and then like what I actually like making. And that's, yeah, like the important thing, I think, because like some people I think will just fall into the trap of like, I'm gonna make just a repeat video of like the one thing that my audience really likes, and that'll drive you crazy.
Yeah.
Is the other thing I'd say.
Can't imagine. Yeah. That we actually have this discussion all the time. Like, I don't know if we've ever done it on the podcast, but we talk about this all the time, whether we actually find YouTube itself to be a creative project. And like, I write as well. I write screenplays. I write all the time. But like, I don't really find YouTube to like be a super fulfilling creative outlet as much as I want it to be. And I just am curious how you feel about that.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's so, YouTube in a lot of ways is close to what I used to, like, I used to work in the news, which is like the most like dry sort of like way of presenting information. And I do think like YouTube kind of started out as like a creative antithesis of that for me, because like in my day job when I worked in news, my job was like, I would write the words that the people on TV that they would say on screen. And like that, you know, it did get dry occasionally. And so like when I first started doing YouTube, like it was a lot more fun to be able to kind of like break things down in that same way, but do it with my own voice. And like, there are like creative bits that I'll do like with my partner here and there in my videos, and that keeps it fresh. But like, it has gotten to the point where now like it is a job. In a way that like when I, you know, I write in my own free time, I try to make time to like write and work on like novels and screenplay drafts and all these ideas I have, and that I find more creative and freeing than kind of like this because it is a job now. If that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's like it's a different muscle you're flexing because all of us sort of make video essays, you know. I think like maybe the subject matter slightly differs, I guess, from person to person, but it's like it's whether you consider the kind of analytical frame of mind you have to be in to write a script like that, like if you consider that to be a creative endeavor or not. I feel like that your mileage will vary based on how you feel about that, you know.
Well, I feel like I don't want to speak for you, Gulev, but I feel like a lot of your creativity kind of gets found in the editing process, right? Like more so than the writing process.
Yeah, that's the majority of it is. I'm always like, oh God, I have to write a script. That's the longest part for me because I'm like, I gotta make this punchy enough. And then once I'm actually sitting down in the edit, I'm like, hey, this will be funny. That's most of my enjoyment is the edit.
Yeah. So, you know, speaking of you being a pop culture YouTuber, like, you know, going back in time again, back when you were a kid, was there like a formative pop culture event that we all remember that made you feel like, oh, this is actually something I'm very passionate about? And like, maybe, you know, not necessarily like, oh, I want to be a YouTuber and talk about pop culture when I get older. But like, was there something that made you feel like, oh, this is really interesting to me and I want to make it part of my life in some way?
That's such a good question. Weirdly enough, and maybe I just have it on my mind because I don't know if any of you guys watch Mike the Snare on YouTube. He does like music video essays. And he was talking about, he did like a deep dive on like the history and career of Michael Jackson. And I was in fifth grade when Michael Jackson died. And that was, I remember, like the biggest like story, like news story that I had ever even like my mind at the time could like ever even conceive of. And like when you're in like fifth grade, you know, you have a very kind of one-dimensional view of like I think current events and things happening around you. Yeah. And so like, you know, with that situation, it was such a big like scandal, and you like, you know, I learned about like his whole kind of like history, not only his music, but also like the scandals that he kind of got into like later in life. And that's also, I think, like one of those things where you learn, like, you know, stories can have different interpretations and different narratives depending on like what sources that you consult. And I feel like that was like kind of a big like, oh my God, like, you know, the way that people talk about pop culture, like not only can inform like, you know, current events in the news cycle, but also just like how we all like behave as people and how we think about things and interpret things. And I remember that being like a very sort of like formative experience of like, you know, it was part of the thing I think that helped me like get into news too. Like just, you know, understanding how people talk about things is like a really, it sounds weird to say, but it's a big thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
No, 100%.
And I feel, oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like it's almost like an underrated like part of like how we interact with each other.
Yeah, yeah, no, totally. That's something that I really, really like about your content. And like, you know, correct me if I'm wrong on this, because I'm not super familiar with like the pop culture video essay or analysis space on YouTube outside of you, really. But that's why I was so happy to find your channel, because I've always been like a pop culture addict, but I guess I've just never really interfaced with people doing, you know, long form analysis on it. So like, you know, media analysis of like film and TV, there's like an overabundance of that on YouTube. Like the three of us do it. I know you do it on your channel sometimes too, but it seems like the pop culture stuff is more your bread and butter. So I'm just wondering, like, when you were dipping your toes into the pop culture analysis space on YouTube, were you thinking like, this is sort of in like an underserved or untapped market on YouTube that you could like really add something interesting to the conversation with?
I think so, because if you look kind of into my niche of people, and the people, like if you look at my YouTube analytics and like, you know, because it'll show you like, oh, this is who your audience also watches. And this is not shade to anybody specific. However, that's what they always say. I think a lot of pop culture content is very easy, and I think sometimes a little lazy, like because it's always, you know, all you have to do
to have
a bare bones pop culture tea spill YouTube channel, right, is do like all of the crazy over sensationalized like all caps headlines about Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni and Hailey Bieber and whoever else, and you do the oversaturated thumbnails of them crying, and you regurgitate some bullshit that you saw on Pop Crave on Twitter, and that's like your channel, and you just like retweets and like that, and like, you know, if you go on like the trends tab, like where like YouTube's like, this is like what other people in your niche are making, like that's my recommendations, and I'm like, that's not what I want. That's not what I ever wanted to be, because I do think that like this kind of like lane of like what I do, and I talk about celebrities and I talk about famous people, it requires more empathy and more nuance than people give it credit for. And I think a lot of it is because, like, I don't know, sometimes it gets boiled down to like, you know, this is like dumb chick stuff, and like, what, you know, people like, it's dumb that people even care about this stuff, but it's not, because like pop culture is politics and politics is everything. And so I think like what I try to do is I just try to bring like empathy and understanding, to the people and situations that I cover in a way that like a lot of these pop culture like tea spill channels do not give a shit about. They don't hold themselves to that standard, and why would they? They don't have to. But I feel like I have to, you know.
Yeah, I've noticed that while you have a lot of energy on your channel, you still are fairly like reserved with your takes on things, which I think is really good. Because I don't watch a lot of pop culture stuff at all, so when I think of it, I think of like TMZ or like those internet drama channels and stuff like that. So I mean, it is kind of a nice change of pace to watch something like your channel.
Oh, go on, Ethan, sorry.
No, what you were describing as well with like the thumbnails and certain types, it's honestly, there's like that same exact group of people on like any kind of we ban those people from this podcast, Star Wars channels that like to talk about, you know, woke
he's calling out Mahler.
I mean, he's one of them, but there's a few worse cases, but you know, the crying thumbnails, the Brie Larson's probably in the thumbnail, that sort of thing, where they call themselves news channels.
Yeah,
just a YouTube problem in general, I think.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure I found you through a Stranger Things video you did that was, you know, something that would fit more in line with like something that any of us would post. And then I started watching your other content, and I was like, wow, this is really good too, because like I said, I'm really into pop culture, and I totally agree with what you said that it is political and it affects everyone. And I think a lot of people interact with it in like a, you know, a meme 3-day news cycle kind of way, but what makes you stand out so much is that you take it seriously and you like really kind of break down the implications of it. And I think that's just a really valuable thing to have online. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, I think like everybody kind of has, if you're a content creator, and I say this as someone who like, I joke all the time, like, oh, like I'm just, you know, I'm memeing, I'm not taking anything seriously. And that's not true. I think if you have a platform and you're like somewhat serious about it, especially, and I especially reserve this standard for the people who like make a lot of money from it, I think you have a duty to like at least be somewhat honest and like not disingenuous in what you're presenting, and also to not treat your audience like children. And I think a lot of people, probably also in your guys' lane as well, and like the, you know, the Maulers of the world and like that kind of like thing, but also in like what I do think there's a lot of like talking down to people, just because like you're the person with the microphone. And I really don't think that's the right way to approach content creation at all. And I think it helps you, like it helps hold you accountable, because you're not in like an echo chamber of like yourself, just like preaching to people who like blindly agree with you. But also like I've been able to change people's minds kind of with what I do. Like I get all the time, like, you know, I'm a very kind of like liberal, like leftist leaning person. And I think you could tell that like if you watch one of my videos, but I get a lot of conservatives who come into my comments and they're like, wow, I was ready to like, you know, turn this off, but I actually listened to what you had to say, and I you changed my mind on this. And I think that's like, that's harder to do. There's a few people I think that like actually kind of commit themselves to doing it, but I try to commit myself to doing it, because it's like, I don't know, I'm making money from this shit. The least I can do is like be ethical and responsible, or at least try to be with my content, you know.
I feel like no comments like that existed. Oh my god.
Yeah, well, I feel like it's her.
I feel like as long as you have a balanced take, the people who are actually giving you those hate comments are usually the people who don't actually watch the whole video.
Oh, that, yeah,
that's true.
I get a lot of those.
Oh my God. It's like the biggest pet peeve of mine where it's like, they'll literally, like, you can tell too, because it's like, you'll post a video and they'll just go off of what it says in the title. And it's like, they'll make a point and you're like, I literally addressed that 2 minutes into the video if you just actually watch it. Like,
I just reply with a timestamp. I'm just like, nope, not doing this.
yeah, commenters like, are wild.
Like, yeah, speaking of the politics of the whole situation, I had a question about that, because something I really admire about your content is the way you kind of like seamlessly integrate straight up political analysis into the pop culture analysis, which, you know, personally, I think is kind of a brave thing to do, because if their channels aren't expressly about politics, it's kind of, you know, it's obviously like a divisive topic to bring up. If you have a big audience, maybe not all of them agree with you, but you're going to say what you believe anyway. And I think that's really cool. So I just wanted to ask, like, how do your politics inform your pop culture takes? And were you always so comfortable sharing them with your audience? Or was that like a hump you had to get over?
I think it was a hump I had to get over at first, because like, you know, it was actually like a big kind of reason why I left news, is because it was directly in conflict with that, where it's like your YouTube channel is you like speaking your mind and your thoughts on things. And I think just kind of like, you know, I was able to keep it separate for a while because like I was, you know, I was talking about like, oh, like why are people mad at this movie that came out, or like this production drama or whatever. But like the more that like, I don't know, you know, we're in the second term of the Trump administration, things are getting ridiculous, and like they kind of always have been, and a lot of that just seeps into art and like you know, celebrities, and it's all connected. And the more that I realized like it was connected, and I couldn't kind of shy away from those things if I wanted to like do a thorough and honest job at talking about an issue, like the more I realized that like it was kind of at odds with like working in like journalism, where it's like the perceived veil of like everyone has to be unbiased in their cut. That's not really how it
yeah
no. Beholden to the stakeholders in the corporations.
Whoever pays the bills gets to say
pays the bills, right? But yeah, I think like, you know, I try to weave it in a way that's not alienating, in a way that's like semi-accessible. But I just think like there are certain things in my videos where it's just like, if I didn't bring in kind of like the harder edge aspect to it, like it'd be like, why are you making the video? You know, like it became a necessity at a certain point, I think.
No, actually, in the Timothy Chalamet video that I brought up at the intro, you made such a great point that I was like, this is such a perfect distillation of what the Harris campaign did wrong during the election. I don't know if Nick and Ethan watched the video, but it's about, you know, it's like analyzing how Timothy Chalamet is kind of like into a bro era with like dating Kylie Jenner and all that stuff. You know, you could explain it better than I am, but she talked about how Tim Walz should have taken like notes from the way Timothy Chalamet has been, his press run for a complete unknown, where he was like going on to ESPN, I guess, and Theo Vaughn and stuff like that. I was like, that's such a great point, and that's what they did wrong. You know, I was like, I love that point.
Well, I mean, the Republican Party did that. They went on fucking Joe Rogan.
About the Democrats. The Democrats should.
No, I know. I'm saying that not even they should have taken notes from Timothy Chalamet. They should have taken notes from their direct competition.
Yeah,
yeah, they should have had Tim Walz up there chatting shit about football, you know? I'd love to see
exactly. Him.
They should have had him on Hot Ones.
They should have had him on Hot Ones, goddammit.
So was there like a single moment or video that just popped off and did really well that made you start feeling more confident? I mean, I know you said YouTube isn't your only career, but like that made you really want to start taking it very seriously. Like, what was that turning point in your career on YouTube?
Yeah, I think it was like how the internet felt of love is kind of the big thing that like, you know, everybody knows. That's even if they don't know me, they know what that is. It's like it's just kind of like
that series,
the thing that precedes me online, which is interesting. But the first one that really blew up was the Lin-Manuel Miranda one. And I remember like it was like the first one I made of that series that like really like took off right away. And like people were talking about it on TikTok. There was like, it got featured on like some TikTok channel that like focuses on like video essay recommendations, and like Hank Green was in the comments like talking about it, and I was like, what the fuck is going on? Like, what is my life? And I think at that point, yeah, it was really cool. And at that point, I was just like, okay, like, time to lock in. I think I can do this. And I made a lot. And that was, oh my God. I can't remember if that was, I think that was 2023 when I made that. And so I just kind of like tried to do a lot more videos in that style. And that series specifically kind of just like took off in a way again that like precedes me for better or for worse. But yeah, that was like the first video where I was like, all right, like, we actually might be cooking with something here. Like, let's see, you know.
And wait, who is the first one on?
The first one was on, actually on Mindy Kaling. And it was in the end of 2022, around when Velma came out. And I was talking about kind of like the controversy with that whole series and like the BJ Novak relationship conspiracy. And so that was the first one. And that one actually did pretty well too. But yeah, the Lin-Manuel Miranda was the second one that I made that like really blew up. And then I did Brendan Urie, and I did like all the other ones after that that you know, became kind of like the well-known thing.
So
I was gonna say, I have a question sort of related to this. I'm obviously less consistent, and I've made less big videos than y'all, but I have this thing where every video that's done well, I knew it was gonna do well. Like, I was just like, I know this one's good, I'm just gonna upload it and it's gonna be fine. And all the ones that did bad, I knew they were going to do bad. Do you kind of have that feeling too? And do you have a way to kind of like, if you do, do you have a way to kind of like put your finger on what that feeling is?
Oh, I do know. I feel like you refine it over the years that you do it. And I think that's like, that's how you get better at like being more consistent kind of with your view count. I think for me, it has a lot to do with like I know, and I'm not gonna do this for reasons that we don't have to get into, but like, I literally know right now, if I made a video that was 12 minutes long and it was just me going like, haha, look at all the stupid shit that Katy Perry's doing on her tour right now, I would literally get 500k views by tomorrow. Like, I know that to be true. And there are times where you want to hit that button and just do the easy thing. And then do that. So there are times I think I know where like, I know like if I make something, it'll just like heat up right away. Like, I'll check like my analytics when I post something and be like, that makes sense. And there's times where it's just like, you know, I'll do kind of like more like niche or quieter topics, and I'm like, this is gonna be one that like builds slowly. I just feel like it's just kind of like, it's less knowing like about you and more just about like what is algorithmically very hot. Like, I can tell, like, what kind of gets pushed in the pop culture algorithm at this point, you know?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So, like, what's your methodology for researching all this stuff? Like, how do you stay up to date and, like, find... Because you find so many things to talk about consistently. Like, what's your methodology on that, you know?
Yeah, I describe myself as, like, a terminally online individual. And I just... I think I try to go for... not necessarily like always what's happening, but what people are talking about. I think in every one of my videos, I mentioned the term discourse, and that really is what it is. Like, if there's a topic, like a big thing that's happening, and there's like multiple sides to like people discussing the issue and multiple takes, and even if like the takes are kind of stupid, like that's when you know, like for me, like when I have something good to talk about where I can just kind of like explain all sides of it, I think, and a lot of like staying kind of like up to date with that is like, you know, I'm on Twitter, for better or for worse, even though I've been kicked off of there 2 times at this point. I am on TikTok, and I see videos of just like people giving their different takes on things, and I'm like, okay, if I can like compile this all into one situation and explain it, then I've got something. It just requires, I think, being very dialed into what people are talking about, more so than like the actual kind of like inciting incident itself.
Right.
Yeah, I'm curious because I actually watched the news video you released, the Katy Perry and Gayle King "Girl Boss Too Close to the Sun," which is great, by the way.
Thank you.
But I'm glad I was watching that, because I thought I was going crazy when I'm just like hearing people being like, well, you know, all this stuff, you know, it doesn't really matter because the entire thing was faked. And I was like, what? are we actually entertaining this as an idea? And then you just jumped into the video. You're like, listen, you've got peasant brain if you believe that. And I was like, oh, thank God. Okay. Yeah, I'm shocked. I'll open Twitter and it's like, they're like, can you guys believe that people think this is real? And it's got like 30,000-40,000 likes. And like, yeah,
we cannot agree on reality anymore. That's one of the biggest problems of the 2020s. For sure.
That's the I lose faith in reality every day, man. Like, just doing this job, like, I have had to, like, there are takes that I have seen that have just broken my brain completely. And, like, that's the price you pay for talking about internet business, I guess. Yeah. But, yeah, totally brain broken.
Yeah, sometimes I'll open Twitter. It's like opening a... I don't know, like there might be a bomb when I wake up in the morning and look at my phone on Twitter and I'm just like, my day is ruined. A bomb went off.
Can I tell you the story of the times I got banned on there? Two times?
Oh, sure.
Since
Elon took over. How do you even get banned? Because they love like the N-A-Z-I words.
Yeah, no, they love, I love when the free speech man loves the free speech. Yes. No, the first time I made a joke, it was my fault. It was around the time that Twitter like started prioritizing like those obvious like rage baity like tweets that were made because like you could get money with the blue checks. And so it was one of those about like it was a self-described landlord doing something shitty. And I quote tweeted it and I was like, wow, like landlords should kill themselves as a joke. It's not my finest. Got banned for that.
No, that's literally great. That's hilarious.
Literally a year later, Tim Pool talked about, I forget what the actual context of what he said was, but he talked about putting his hands on a woman, and then I quote tweeted it, and I said, if I ever see Tim Pool on the street, I'm beating the fuck out of him with my bare hands, and I got banned.
Wow.
You and the inciting violence.
I got banned for inciting violence twice, but that's fine. I'm back and I'm very careful about what I say on there because I don't want to get banned again. I'm reformed.
Tim Pool, the one is like, I swear I'm a liberal, but I hate liberals and I hate everything on the left, but I am a liberal. I hate that.
I'm definitely a centrist.
I hate that shit. Oh my God. Never
take this beanie off.
Speaking of, you know, like Elon's Twitter, because so much of your research for videos and stuff and, you know, just drumming up ideas that you're working with comes from Twitter. So like, I don't know if you guys agree with this, but when I'm scrolling through Twitter now, it's a completely different experience than it was before Elon got it. Now I feel like I see so much like disgusting shit constantly. And it's like, is that kind of affecting your job? Like you have to sift through so much more bullshit to actually find the stuff you're looking for?
Yeah, absolutely. It's gotten to the point because it's like, and it's stupid that like this small change like literally did so much harm to the information ecosystem, but like it's literally anybody can have the goddamn blue check now. And so you have like, you know, these pop crave adjacent accounts where they're like entertainment news, but they're just saying stuff that is literally not correct. And then everybody just believes it because they see the blue check and they go, well, you know, but like I'm looking at it, but like I'm reading this. So it must be true. And it's like, it's not, it's actually crazy. No. Like a lot of like what I do, I feel like is I just spend time like debunking people who are so obviously doing and saying shit in bad faith. And I'm like, this can't be it, man. This can't be all that we are now. But I do feel like that's what I spend most of my time doing online.
Yeah, it's a disaster. I like all the For You page is like completely junk now. Like I'll scroll it. Not only are the only posts I see, I'll just be like, not interested. And then it'll be like, here's this person that thinks white people are being oppressed. I'm like, nope, I'm not interested in you. And it's like, here's someone getting shot in the head. No, thank you. Oh, here's an OnlyFans model. No, thank you. And then all the ads, even like there's no like actual advertisers. They're just weird people paying for ads because no actual company wants to be associated with this website.
Yeah. No, it's unbelievable.
I don't get on it.
So getting back to YouTube first. This is my last question before our rapid fire section. But, mm-hmm. you know, I don't really have a huge following on YouTube. None of us really do at the moment. Our channels are like sort of in their infancy. We have like a couple thousand subscribers between us all. But you know, so like all the pressure that we have to keep consistent with YouTube, it's all self-imposed. Like we just have to keep up with YouTube because we want to eventually turn it into something, you know. But for you, that's not really the case because you do have a lot of people who have presumably made like consuming Kayla Says content sort of like a part of their daily or weekly routine at that point. So like if you're just not feeling it, or if you're sick, or if whatever, you know, you're feeling down blue that week or whatever, like how do you deal with the pressure of knowing there are a lot of people who are expecting to hear something from you that day? And it's like a creative endeavor, you know, like is that hard to deal with?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are times like when I definitely like don't like the you know, the brutality of the world gets to me and I do not want to make a video. It's the last thing I want to do. And I'm kind of like, I'm like a machine in the way that like if I really needed to pull it together and like get a video done in like 3 to 4 hours, I could do it, and I have done that, because there's this kind of like constant fear of like, you know, I have trained this algorithm to expect at least one video from me per week, and I have to keep that up, or like it's, I'm gonna get abandoned and forgotten. And it's like, you can kind of debate like how much of that is all in your head versus how much of that is legitimate. And I've gotten to this point where like I used to do 2 videos a week. And now I only do one, and I make them a little bit longer, and I make them a little bit more like thought out. I think it's just like trying to have balance sort of like in your real life, and also like having a separation is really important to me. Like, you know, I don't get these people who like they put their entire personal business online, and so it feels like your audience is like more of an active participant in your life than you want them to be, and then there is no separation. An important thing for me is like my audience, like some of them, yeah, they get a little parasocial with me, I will not lie, but it's like they don't know anything that I don't want them to. And so when I like take my headphones off and I leave the computer and I go and I hang out with my partner or with my family or something, they have no fucking idea what I'm up to. And like that brings me peace, and it makes me feel more connected to the world. Because I do love the people who subscribe to me. I really do. And I do think I have like a great community and stuff. There are some people who will just like go out of your way to like make you feel like you're crazy. Either by just like deliberately interpreting you in bad faith, the parasocial stuff, you know, being frustrated, like when, you know, you maybe didn't deliver on like a promise of like, oh, I said I was going to do this video, I ended up doing something else. I think it's just like keeping that real life separation is very important.
Yeah, I feel you. So I'm about to go into rapid fire. Do you guys have any last questions before we get into that?
No, I think I'm good. Let's okay. Fire the chamber.
So yeah, piggybacking off of that a bit. What's, if you don't have an answer for this, that's fine. But I feel like I kind of do. So I was wondering if you did too. Do you have like a single most memorable comment you've ever received? Like whether it's for a good or bad reason?
Oh my God. So many. I have so many. I think one of the craziest ones that I've gotten was, your eyes look so, like, it was something like, your eyes look so beautiful and lively, but it also kind of looks like you just did a line of coke. And that one, like, really stands out in my head, because I'm like, you have to assume so much to get to that point. But that's a good one for me. That's a funny one I always go back to.
Yeah, that's a roller coaster of a compliment sandwich.
Yeah.
So who's the most consistently interesting celebrity in your opinion?
Oh, consistently interesting. Nathan Fielder. I just watched that.
Oh my God, yeah. Absolutely.
And I also, I love Nathan for you. I love The Curse. I think he is he is operating on levels unlike anyone else right now. And I just have such massive respect for what he does. He's interesting in the sense that like his work speaks for himself. Like he doesn't have to like he's obviously eccentric and weird, but he lets it all show through his work in the most like fun ways, where like I never know what he's thinking until I watch the latest episode of like whatever he's doing. I'm obsessed with him. Yeah.
The funniest thing about the first episode of The Rehearsal is like he gets through 15 minutes of talking about like airline safety and like trying to prevent airline crashes and stuff. And he's like, we've gone through 15 episodes without a single laugh. But I was like, I've been laughing this entire time. Just like the sheer strangeness of it all, you know?
He's so funny. We were just like watching, like we just watched the latest episode of the rehearsal. And then after that, like we just started going down to like a Nathan For You rabbit hole. And it's just still so fucking good. Like
the last episode of Nathan For You literally blew me away. I was just like, what the fuck is happening?
Which episode is that one again?
Where he's helping the Bill Gates impersonator go find his long lost love.
Yeah,
that's right.
Finding Francis. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
So funny.
That was a super long episode. It was like documentary length.
Yeah, it was like a straight up movie. It was insane.
That must have been sort of the impetus for the rehearsal, I guess. You know, he's just like,
I think so. I think
wanted to do more long form stories after that.
Yeah.
Actually, I met Nathan Fielder one time. It was
oh my God.
Yeah, when I first moved to New York, I was a dog walker and I saw him. It was like sort of like lunchtime and I was walking by with this like really, really cute dog who's, you know, I saw Nathan. I wasn't sure if I could go up to him, but the dog luckily just like walked over to the group. So I was like, oh, hi, how's it going? And I was just like, I just want to thank you, Nathan. Like your work means so much to me. Like, I think you're a genius. I just want to really say thank you. And he was very kind and appreciative, but he was like trying to move me along, you know, because all of his he was like holding court outside of a bar, probably planning the rehearsal because it wasn't that much longer before that. But yeah, he was like, okay, bye Augie. That was the dog's name. So I was like, I'm sorry. but yeah.
That's a great story though.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really cool to meet him. So yeah, last rapid fire question. What's your favorite award show moment ever? Any award show?
Oh my God, wait, that's such a good question. Let me think about it for a sec. Favorite award show moment ever. Okay, this might be like a really random one, but it's the one that stands out in my head. Henry Winkler getting his Emmy for Barry and everybody giving him a standing ovation. Rules. So good. I just love Barry.
I saw that.
Love Henry Winkler. And he was just like so excited. Everybody was so excited for him. And it's just somebody who's like a huge fan of that show. Like that was a really cool moment to see for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk about someone who really deserved their comeback, you know, because he kind of got forgotten there for a while, but he's such a great actor. He's such a lovable persona, you know, I really love Henry Winkler.
We can all thank Adam Sandler for keeping him in the spotlight.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shout out to Adam Sandler, man.
I know you asked Kayla, but I got two answers, actually. I got a funny one and then a really genuinely sweet one. I'll start with the sweet one. It was when Bong Joon-ho won Best Director and just got that amazing standing ovation where he just like thanked Marty. That like brought a tear to my eye. That was a really beautiful moment. And then on a funnier side, please welcome the wickedly talented one and only Adele Dazeem.
Yeah. So cringe. Oh my God.
I love that clip so the much.
The one that messes me up all the time, whenever Eminem's like dressed up like some kind of superhero and then he like ass plants. Whose face did he ass plant into? It was like the MTV Music Awards. That show was hilarious.
Elton John?
It wasn't Elton John. It was
Elton John had a weird thing for a while, I remember. But I mean, obviously, you know, my favorite, I don't know, this is pretty toxic of me, is keep my wife's name out your fucking mouth. That was
what
just like so
what
insane.
An amazing this moment of history.
Yeah. I watch that so often. I go back to it to watch it. It's just an insane clip.
So crazy.
But oh yeah. All right. So let's start talking about Raising Arizona. Kayla, you recommended this movie. Why'd you recommend it for the pod?
I recommended this movie because I actually, I first saw the intro of it in a film study class that I took in high school. We specifically played like the first, like, I think 11 minutes or whatever it is, like before like the title card. And I just remember being like so enthralled with it and being like, okay, I have to, and like we were using it as an example of like, you know, a good kind of like, you know, narration and setup for a film. And so I was like, I have to go and like watch the rest of this movie. And so I went home and I watched it and I was like, I just loved it. It like made me realize, like one of those movies that like made me realize like, oh, like, this is what films can be. And it's like a cool gem that like, I just feel like I never would have like come across, you know, obviously I would have, like, because I was, like, into film and stuff, but it was, like, the first Coen Brothers movie I ever saw. And I just loved it. And it's, like, been one of my favorites, like, since then, because it's just so strange and weird. And it's in my top four on Letterboxd. And I like to recommend it to people who maybe haven't seen it. But, yeah, it's great. Love it.
Had you guys seen it before this, Ethan and Nick?
No.
I have not seen this. When I was a kid, like, I was obsessed with dark comedies. Like, even if they were shitty, anything that was a dark comedy at, like, Blockbuster, I would grab. And I love Raising Arizona. It's so absurd.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned the narration section before. It's kind of like, it's very Scorsesean. I don't know if that's even a word. But, like, the way Marty, basically almost all of his movies start with a narration section. And considering this is one of the Coens' first movies, it feels like they definitely are wearing their influences on their sleeve, you know, opening the film that way. But it's also way more absurd and heightened than anything Marty would do. So it's got their own stamp on it, but I remember feeling like, oh, this is them kind of like finding their way, and they're kind of like using Scorsese as like an on-ramp into that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, going into this, I was not expecting this to be as funny as it was. Like, I didn't really know what to expect going in. But I think, like, one of my favorite, it was like a visual gag. It was when he punches his, like, brother-in-law and he falls down, and then it cuts in the reverse shot and he's like 20 feet away and he just, like, walks up to him.
That was his boss.
Yeah, it was boss and brother-in-law or whatever.
But the funniest thing to me is, like, Nicolas Cage was the most reserved actor in the entire film. Like, everybody else was at a 10 and he's just actually acting well. It was insane.
Yeah.
I was watching this with my wife was in the next room over, and she was just like, "Well, this movie, I don't know what's happening, but everyone's yelling. There's so much yelling. Everyone's just screaming."
it's so absurd and over the top, and one of my favorite, like, scenes in it, like, cuz I was rewatching it, like, a little earlier. And, like, just the scene where he robs, like, he goes back and he robs for the Huggies, and, like, he's running around the grocery store, and the cops and shit, and, like, the store owner, they just, like, have guns and are shooting at him the whole, like, and it's just, like, so, like, right
it's
to
so
a 10.
Absurd.
Like, they're just shooting the groceries, and, like, it's all, like, just, like, exploding, and it's, like, in a real situation, they would just let the guys, like, steal the fucking diapers, but because it's, like, in this, like, world, in this tone, everything is, like, so over the top and, like, slapsticky and, like, violent. I love it. So
and the dogs,
and there's like a
too.
Horde of dogs chasing through the house.
Yeah,
like they
the
keep cutting back to like 20 dogs running through someone's
home.
And
the biker just throwing grenades at everything.
Oh, yeah.
The music during the chase scene was amazing. I love the yodeling. So great.
Do you guys think that the biker inspired the villain from the SpongeBob SquarePants movie?
Oh, my God.
Probably, honestly.
It feels like it.
Wait, that's such a good connection.
Kind of vibe.
Wow.
What's
I never
weird
thought
to me
of
is
that
the...
before.
The biker almost feels like he doesn't really exist, but he also does. Like, it's so
he
fucking
dreams
surreal.
Him into existence. I had a dream.
Yeah. No, I think I feel like Leonard Small is sort of a precursor to Anton Chigurh in No Country for Old Men. Like, obviously, the tones are completely different. Like, that movie is so dead serious, but I feel like they kind of perfected this character archetype with Anton Chigurh. You know what I mean? Like, I kept thinking that. Is he, like... Is he supernatural? He kind of operates in a supernatural way. He seems to know everything constantly, and or you know until the very end when he gets one pulled over on him and dies. But
I'd even say No Country for Old Men is funny, like in a very dry way.
It's got its moments, but yeah, it was interesting seeing the like because I love No Country for Old Men. That's on one of my Letterboxd top four. And it really is like, oh man, this is, you know, Raising Arizona is not exactly a Western, but it's kind of got the same vibe and a bit of the aesthetic. So it's just such a like cool comparison because you have one that's incredibly bleak and sorrowful and then like a very optimistic story, but it's, you know, and this over the top slapstick. It's just a really cool comparison to see them one after the other.
One really weird thought I was having during this, I kept on thinking that it's so weird how both Holly Hunter and Nick Cage are part of the DCEU. I was thinking, I was like, they're both just like, because Nick Cage, Nick Cage, remember he plays like the alternate version of Superman in The Flash, and Holly Hunter.
Oh,
plays,
I forgot
like,
about that.
Holly Hunter plays
the
senator.
Oh, and Holly Hunter's the senator with the pee in the jar.
Yeah.
Oh,
Granny's Peach Tea.
Oh my
I forgot
God.
About that.
My boyfriend and I remember the Flash, we went to see that just to see if that was real. Like, if that rumor of, like, Nick Cage no being
way.
Super.
There's no way they actually did that.
Yeah, and we were like, holy shit, I guess we have to go see it to see if it's actually real. And then we were like, oh my fucking God, I forgot that happened. Holy shit.
Yeah, I saw it was an interview Nick Cage did after The Flash came out, and he was like, yeah, I showed up and like I got in a costume and we acted out a whole scene, and then I went to go see it and it just wasn't me. It was just like the entire scene was different now, and I was just like really young looking.
It's like a PS2 video
yeah,
game rendering.
Like video game cutscene.
That's yeah. so funny. Yeah. This is one of my favorite Nick Cage roles. It's probably like this, like Raising Arizona, not The Flash. and yeah, and Moonstruck as well, if you guys have ever seen that. That's a great movie that he's
yeah,
in. But no, I just I love his performance. And this film, I just feel like he's like, yeah, he's reserved kind of in all the right ways. And he's like weirdly like insightful at points, like especially in some of his narration. And like it's
yeah,
just
the
like
monologue
it's
was great.
So good. And I just love that it's like, you know, it's supposed to be like in another like world, you're kind of supposed to just like mock and laugh at like this like dumb, like, you know, hick kind of character. But like he has like these very kind of like quiet, profound moments. And that's also something that I really love about it. I just think like his monologue moments are always really cool and like really well delivered too.
Oh yeah, for
no, I
sure.
Agree. I think it's definitely his best performance. I don't like yeah. it's not my favorite, but it's 100% his best performance.
Yeah.
Well, it's weird that he was only 21 whenever they filmed this movie. Isn't that fucking crazy?
Really?
Yeah, it's crazy.
I think adaptation is kind of more of an impressive performance, at least.
Mm, that's true.
Maybe. But I mean,
well,
I
you guys
know.
Are
this
wrong. It's
too.
Vampire's Kiss.
Vampire. That's what I was going to bring up. It's very interesting because this. When did Vampire's Kiss come out? Like basically around
it was
the
like
same
5 years,
time as this,
like
right?
A couple of years before, maybe even.
Oh.
Yeah, so this was like peak Nick Cage being a total weirdo on screen. I guess like maybe the Coens just kind of told him like that's not what we want for
calm
this.
Down,
like, yeah.
Well, maybe they just told everybody else to act crazy and
intimidate.
They're like, you just be as normal as you can be.
Yeah. No,
it's kind of like what he said about what they said about his wife, where he's like, I have a checkered past, but my wife is a officer of the law, twice decorated. Kind of evens out.
Yeah,
he's like, we're hoping it would even out for
yeah.
adoption.
I do think it's interesting that, like, Raising Arizona is. You guys can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I feel like it's probably the most lighthearted film in the Coen Brothers filmography. Would you guys agree with that?
Maybe.
Maybe
no. I don't know. I hear Inside Llewyn Davis is a
Burn
real
After
peach
Reading is fairly lighthearted. Lighthearted.
Yeah, but. This is way more slapstick than Burn After.
What about
Reading.
Like Hail Caesar? I haven't seen that one, but that does not look like it takes itself super seriously.
Yeah, but it's just not to this degree. Like they've never really made a movie like this before or since, where it's like it's basically a slapstick comedy.
The Big
Lebowski.
Big Lebowski is pretty close to this, but not to the extent as you get it in this.
Yeah, actually, you're right. Maybe it is the Big Lebowski. I'm just talking about, you know, you're watching John Goodman and the other dude just scream. They're just screaming in the car covered in blue paint for like a minute on end. Like, I don't even think that would be the Big Lebowski. That's too.
And whenever he's yanking him out of the ground, like the poo color poo ground.
Oh, and he's like grabbing,
just screaming.
Back
it was
out.
Like a 5 minute segment.
Yeah,
John Goodman was great in this movie, by the way.
I was gonna say, I almost like forget. Sometimes I just forget that he's in this, and then when I go back and watch it, I'm like, oh my God, like, and he's just like such like an underrated, like, I think like his physical comedy is just like so funny. Like in the scene, like where like they're, you know, they're like attacking each other like in the house, and they're like throwing each other around on the counter and shit. Like it's so, I love John Goodman. But yeah, this is a really good performance from him.
I wonder how old he was in this movie. I should have looked that up because he's one of those people that just lives in my mind as like a distinguished, grizzled old man. You know, just seeing him be, it looked like he might be in his like late 20s in this role. And I was like, wow.
Yeah, I would say he's probably like 30 or somewhere around there.
Yeah. He looked good.
Yeah. There's a few actors like that where they just in my mind have always been old. Like Willem Dafoe has always been like very old to me, you know?
Yeah.
Well, even him and, like, Roseanne, he wasn't, like, crazy old. He's just a large man.
Large man and very dad-coded.
Yes.
Like, he's just, like, a very dad-coded individual.
Yeah.
That's true.
Hugh Jackman is another one. Like, when I was watching one of the early X-Men movies, and I was like, he looks basically indistinguishable from how he looks in Deadpool and Wolverine. I was like, his face is a little bit more grizzled, like, a little bit more lined, but he just looks like the same person. It's crazy. And then I guess, I don't know, who else? like Richard Morgan Harris, Freeman. Morgan Freeman. Yeah, there's a lot of people like that. But yeah, thank you so much for recommending this movie, because I haven't seen it in so long, and it was really fun to revisit it again. It's just such a great time.
Yeah, I loved it.
The one thing I was kind of going in, I knew it was a Coen Brothers film, but that's why the tone and kind of comedic level really caught me off guard. But I was very happy that this was not like a bummer of a movie at the end. I was like, this is a very optimistic, you know, it's a bittersweet, but it's still way more optimistic than the majority of their filmography. And I was like, this is a very like just nice message to go out. You know, I do find the scene funny when they're like returning the baby. And the guy's just like, all right, go out the way you came.
Yeah, I love that, like, that dream sequence at the end, because it kind of leaves everything, like, very, you know, open-ended intentionally. But it does kind of, like, leave on this sort of optimistic and, like, beautiful note. And I also just, like, I love how it kind of matches, like, the whole, like, dreamy kind of like bright aesthetic of the film, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's, yeah, and it's definitely different, like, for a Coen Brothers project for sure. But yeah, I think that's like what makes it so like unique, and it's like, you know, you shouldn't like these people either. I think that's what I like about, like, they stole a baby. Like, you know what I mean? You shouldn't like
it's
them.
It's fine. He had too many.
Right. Like, you shouldn't want to like root for them, but like they at the core of it, they're just like very kind of like, you know, simple people who got like a raw kind of hard deal in life, and they're just trying to make the best of it. And I just think like the way, and like credit to Nicolas Cage and Holly Hunter, I love the way that they portray it too. I just think like it's cool that you like are very endeared to them the whole time, I think.
Yeah.
And I think it's funny that
go on, Nick, sorry.
Oh, go ahead. Well, I was gonna say, I think it's funny that like every single person but the parents like loved that baby more than they did. Like, everyone was obsessed with the fucking baby.
How could you not be?
That little scene where the John Goodman's in the car and after they stolen the baby, and they're just like, oh man, what a sweetie pie. They're just like absolutely gushing over him.
One of the funniest things to me is they just, the furniture owner, like, as soon as the baby's back, he's like, ah, you know, I know you kidnapped my child, but I don't want you guys to get divorced. I mean, you know, you got to work that out. He starts doing like couples counseling for his kidnappers. It's like, this is awesome.
And the guy who played the boss was like the best fucking asshole in the entire world. He played it so well. Oh my, I wanted to punch him.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah, so good.
So Kayla, like, what's your favorite movie of the 2020s so far? If you had to pick one, or like a handful that stick out to you.
Oh my goodness. I feel like I have to kind of go back in my head a bit. But I think we had a lot, maybe it's recency bias. I think we had a lot of really good stuff last year. Challengers, I love. And I will forever be bitter that it didn't get more like award season love. I'm trying to think of what else. Tick, Tick, Boom. I love a good movie musical. And I think that one like sticks out in my head. That was like 2021, I think. And Andrew Garfield should have won for that for sure. Cause that was the Will Smith year. Yeah. I'm trying to think of what else. What about you guys? What's your like?
I'm big on Sinners right now, but that's also recency bias.
Sinners is great. Love Sinners.
Probably Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Oh yeah,
that's I haven't liked that many movies in the last like 5 years, honestly.
We just talked about Oppenheimer on the podcast a couple of days ago. That might be one of it's maybe not my very first one, but it's definitely up there. A lot of these movies would come from 2023, so like Poor Things would be another one that's a really big favorite of mine. It's funny how, like, you know, you mentioned Will Smith winning. It's so funny how like the people who get all this hype during that cycle of awards. Now we're like, who the hell is talking about King Richard at this point? You know, like,
literally King, like, what is that? I don't even think I saw
the Green Book.
Yeah. It was good. Oh, like, King Richard was good, but it feels like it just came and went, kind of like it doesn't really have much staying power, which is a lot of these movies that
I didn't like King Richard, but I actually really liked Green Book. I watched it after everybody was shit talking it on the podcast, and I was just like, it's like, why did everybody hate this fucking movie? And then I really enjoyed it.
We make fun of Nick for that being like one of his premium old man dad takes. It's like, Green Book was actually, it was a very heartwarming film.
You like what you like, you know?
I really liked Anora too. I don't think that's recency bias, because I'm like obsessed with everything Sean Baker makes.
Yeah.
So I probably the substance as well, but that's a recency thing. But man, I love the substance. I think the substance is so badass.
Substance is so fun. Great film.
So fun.
So let's dig into The Last of Us a little bit, because you know, third episode just dropped.
Wait, we didn't rate the movie.
Oh yeah,
we Raising Arizona. I'm gonna give this I'm sitting at a 9 out of 10 right now. This might be a 10 out of 10 on a rewatch, but it's really, really good, and I can't really find any faults with it so far.
I'm at 8.5.
Nice.
I'm at an 8.
Do I rate too? I'm gonna give it a 10. This is my recommendation. I'll give it a 10.
That's all right.
Nice.
Awesome.
Yeah. Again, thank you for recommending.
Yeah.
This.
Thanks
it
for the
really
rec.
Fun
yeah.
Watch.
That's,
yeah.
This is a fun
I'm glad
watch.
You. Glad you guys liked it. It was cool to like just go back and revisit because I haven't watched it in a while. So
I miss when movies were all 90 minutes. This was a nice breeze.
That's the other
true.
Thing about it. Yeah. So
it's so,
so
quick.
Tight. Yeah. For sure.
But yeah, like speaking of The Last of Us, I feel like this would be, it's kind of fertile ground for you to make a video on, Kayla, because it seems like there's so much controversy surrounding this show right now, at least, or not necessarily controversy, more just like people bullying the shit out of Bella Ramsey for numerous reasons. Like, I feel like that would be something that you would potentially talk about. I don't know if you're planning it, but I could see that popping up on my homepage, like something from you on that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's definitely in the pipeline because I do think, like, I don't know. They just had a lot of, I don't know. The season one of The Last of Us, like the show, I think was really good and I really enjoyed it. I think they were always going to have a challenge with season two. And I think the thing that gets lost for me, and this is probably what I would make a video about if I were to make one, is like, I do think that like a lot of the shit that Bella Ramsey gets is not fair. And I think a lot of it is like very overblown and like very misogynistic and homophobic and weird. I do think that they still look very young to play season two Ellie, or like The Last of Us part two Ellie. And I think that's like part of the disconnect that I'm having, but there's also a lot of other disconnect problems I'm having with season two so far, but
which
yeah.
is interesting because they're the exact age that Ellie is in that story, but like game Ellie does look closer to like mid-20s actually, I think.
Yeah,
but it's funny because they were playing older in season one, because I think Bella Ramsey was like 18 during season one.
Yeah,
and now they're yeah.
Do you have context like with the game, Kayla? Are you a gamer, American?
I played the first game.
You a gamer, American.
Are you a gamer? I played the first game, and then the second game I did not play, but I was, like, up on, like, I watched, like, walk, like, I know what happens. Like, I've watched, like, Let's Plays of it, but
you
the first
Nick
one I
You and Nick
watched
the cutscenes. Yeah.
I was telling Nick, that's how I consume video games. I'm like, if you watch the cutscenes, you always win. You never have to deal with any of the boring game
I can understand.
Stuff.
I can understand watching somebody play the game, but, like, for Last of Us specifically, a lot of the storytelling is through the actual gameplay, not just the cutscenes.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure. I'm getting not the full experience, but I'm just not a gamer. I can't bring myself to game. You
can still watch somebody else play the game for you.
Yeah. I don't know how you find the time for it, Kayla. You have a full-time job. You have like a really successful YouTube channel. You seem so busy, just like all the stuff you have going on in your life.
I am a busy bitch for real. No, I wish I had more time to actually play games. We have an Xbox here. I went through a phase for a while, actually last winter, where I think I don't know if I was like depressed or whatever, but I like revisited GTA 5 really hardcore, and I was just like driving
That's
around
so
in
good.
GTA Online, like picking
oh,
fights
man.
With people, and like I made time for that because it was important to me at the time. But yeah, these days, not as big of a gamer as I'd like to be. But yeah,
I feel like no matter where and at what point in your life you are, busy is kind of a mindset to an extent, because you always have time, or not everybody, I guess, but most people have the time. It's just how much time do they want to do nothing? You know?
Yeah,
that's true.
That's true, yeah.
And also, I think that's an American mindset, because you look at Europeans and they're just like, wow, Americans poorly manage their time because they're constantly busy and working, where we manage it to where we get so much free time to relax and hang out. Because like the American,
right,
like we're stressed out if we don't have something to do. Like, that's me. Yeah. I have, like, way too many damn hobbies. I can't keep up with anything.
Well, they have like 4-hour work weeks and shit in some countries.
Yeah.
If I sat down and logged the amount of time I'm sitting on my ass, either staring at my phone, my computer, or just doing absolutely nothing, like, I could have done anything. I could have done anything.
Yeah, the screen time that I log on my phone is abysmal. The numbers are very embarrassing.
But you can justify it because that's research.
Exactly. Time is money.
Yes.
It's like... I think Bella Ramsey has a very different take on Ellie than I do. I think she took a lot of the aspects of the character that I liked and didn't really find herself in those. And that's my biggest problem. Like, I think she really just took Ellie as this, like, annoying, like, uptight, kind of, like, dickish chick. And I don't think that's really Ellie. I think she's rough around the edges, but I think she has a lot more heart than what she's showing for Ellie as a character, personally.
Yeah, I don't have I don't have context to say. But, I mean, just in terms of last week, or, you know, last night's episode, I really did love how they just took their sweet time mourning Joel, because that's the only way you can really handle killing off a character that's as integral to a story as Joel was.
Oh, spoilers, by the way, everybody.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're talking about the third episode, you know.
Yeah.
They gotta know by this point. But, watching Tommy, like, you know, clean his body off, and Ellie goes and visits the grave, and, you know, the council scene where I talk about that. And it was also good how you heard the, you know, varying opinions at the council. The surprising moment of that, like, homophobic prick guy just...
Oh, Seth.
Yeah, Seth being, like, the one that actually stands up for Ellie's point of view, which was really interesting, too. And they have kind of, like, a weird alliance.
Kind of weird kinship, yeah.
Yeah, that was cool. There's a lot of things I did like about it. So I'm hopeful, like, tentatively hopeful for where it could go.
That's how Seth was a real like, I'm so sorry about that. I'm an ally through and through.
He's an ally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think my hesitancy is, and I say this as somebody, again, played the first game, and I liked season one, and I liked the changes that they made for TV. I think I'm not as big of a fan of the story of the game, the season two game, as a lot of people are not. I know it's very divisive, but I think that's something that the game has that the show doesn't have is the benefit of, like, perspective, and that you are literally playing as Ellie and you are literally playing as Abby. And I think that's the point, is, like, viewing this kind of, like, you know, survival story from two different perspectives in a very, like, in-depth way, because you're literally taking on the persona of that character. And I think season two of the show is, like, because they can't do that, you're not playing it, you're just watching it. I do feel like... What do you mean they can?
All they had, like, if I was writing this episode, right?
Yeah.
How I would have handled it is I wouldn't have even introduced Abby at all. Mm. And I would have just introduced her right before Joel is killed. And then the next episode, following similar to the game, now we're shown Abby, now we're following Abby, and everyone's like, what the fuck is happening? That's how you get your shock value to your, like, as a replacement to how it's done in the game. That, or they really needed to build up everything, make us understand Abby as a character throughout, like, half of this season before they kill Joel. I feel like those are the only two options where it actually works. Either shock value, or they just take away all the shock value and make it an understandable situation.
But that's, yeah, they did make it an understandable situation, right? That's what you're saying?
Yeah.
Not really, no, they didn't. They didn't spend enough time.
They dipped their
toes in to making us understand Abby. That's all they did.
The first scene of the entire season is Abby, isn't it? It's like they introduced
for like 2
him.
Seconds saying, oh man, I really fucking hate this guy.
But then, oh, and she says he's handsome.
For good reason, though. He killed everyone.
Yeah, but then you get the whole, like, because in the game, when she kills Joel, it's just like, you stupid old man, and doesn't give him anything, and then just beats him to death. And then in the show, she gets a whole monologue where you actually do get the chance to understand. I'm sure it's, you know, it's not episodes worth of buildup, but at least I feel like they're trying to lessen the shock value that so many people had issues with in the game story, because you don't get, like, any scenes with Joel in the game before he's off.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think... Neil Druckmann is a big part of this, right? He's like effectively a co-creator. I'm sure a lot of him changing the story so much in these early phases of season two is a direct response to how people responded to the game, how many people stopped playing. They're like, we have to do something to try to like accommodate viewers who are going to be like, what the fuck? Pedro Pascal isn't a part of my favorite show anymore. Like, you got to do something to kind of like cushion that blow, you know? I don't think you could just be like, shock value, he's dead. You know, that would be crazy. Because
then you're going to have the same issue. Yeah.
I think they absolutely could. And I think they absolutely should have, personally.
I know you're saying, Kayla, how it's like, it's easier to understand when you're actually in the shoes of the character because you are controlling them. But I know so many people that as soon as they start playing as Abby, they went, well, I'm not playing anymore. I'm done. I'm not playing half of the game as Abby.
And look, that game was so divisive when it came out. It's still divisive now. And I just think they, no matter what, they were going to have a rough time. Because the whole point is that, like, literally the point is that you get so attached to Joel and Ellie in this relationship in the first, you know, story of the game and in the first season, and now it's like you have to contend with the fact that he literally just gets offed. You know what I mean? And like, that's just, it's tough. Neil Druckmann wrote it facilitated it in a tough way in the game. I think they were kind of screwed no matter what they did for this season. But
yeah.
Kind of. But I mean, there's also, they took away a lot of the aspects of Abby that make you kind of relate to her. Like, there's a reason she's fucking jacked in the game. It's because she literally she spent 4 years training to kill this guy, right? Like, had they built that up and made it more of a revenge story for her, people would understand that. People have watched revenge movies for fucking decades, right? There's a lot of ways they could have attacked this that would have made people relate to the story a lot more. And I think they didn't focus on the right things for me so far.
I thought you were just saying that you didn't want them to focus on Abby at all, though.
No, I said they had two paths. They could either build it up way more than they did, or they could go full shock value. I think both of those are like them taking an actual path as opposed to being like, let's just soften the damage here instead of making something like actually genuinely good and impactful.
You have to admit, it's a powerful visual just starting the season off with the ramifications of just the Joel's choice in the last episode of season one, though. Like, they're standing at a gravesite for like 15 people. Like, that's a powerful image.
I get that, but it's also Ellie's still crying like a little fucking baby after like 4 years, and then they just randomly decide to reconcile the day before he's fucking killed. The timing doesn't make any fucking sense. It's like, come on.
Wait, what do you, Ellie's crying? What do you mean? When was she crying?
She hates him. She hates Joel. She absolutely despises him.
We're missing context in the show still.
The day before Joel gets murdered, she's like, I'm gonna go on a watch with Joel. I love him again. It's like, okay.
Well, yeah, we're missing
the context. Hated him for 4 years now. Sure, we've missing the context, but it's still like annoying to watch.
I mean, yeah, she's mad at him. That doesn't mean she's not gonna be fucking really upset when he dies. Right? I mean,
that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying, like, the whole timeline doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't know. Like I said,
it's a divisive show. It's everybody's.
That's what
divisive
I've been
till the
for.
End of time. Yeah.
This whole season, I kind of knew. I was like, you know, season one was kind of going to be a slam dunk, no matter what anyone's opinions on it are. If they just did the bare minimum and did a fine, decent, okay enough job, it would be universally praised because it's such a solid story to make and adapt. And that's exactly what happened. And then I was more excited because I'm like, oh, I cannot wait to get into more Last of Us 2 discourse because that was such a nightmare to be a fan of the games when that happened.
Yeah.
Well,
and to see all the reactions of the whole Joel thing is from someone who knew it was going to happen was very funny.
I just think the show kind of lacks balls. The season two, like season one, at least they took some risks. The things they changed, like, were things that possibly could rustle some feathers, like the Nick Offerman episode, stuff like that. Nick. And this season, I feel like they had an opportunity to kind of like, Nick. I don't know, shake things up.
What?
You said rustle feathers. That's rustling leaves. You meant ruffle feathers.
Oh, whatever.
So I read a really funny tweet the other day about The Last of Us. It was like, gamers finally had our I know what happens, I read the book moment. You know what I mean? Like, it was finally time for gamers to be like, yeah, it's coming. I thought that was
that's
cool.
True.
Because usually it's like people who read all the Game of Thrones book.
Game of Thrones.
Wait for season 3, episode 9.
Wait for the Red Wedding.
Yeah.
You guys will be blown away.
Yeah. Is this.
That still fucked me up.
Like,
season 1.
Is the death of Joel a Red Wedding or Ned beheading? I didn't mean to rhyme that. But is it that level moment in like television history, do you think?
Yes. My wife literally said the exact same thing. Because. She was like, I feel like I just watched the Red Wedding.
Yeah.
I think it is if you don't know. I feel like it could be that level of like shock if you just legitimately don't know. Fortunately, like I just feel like, yeah, if you know the game, it's like not as like, oh, it's happening. But yeah, for people who literally like have no context, like I'm sure that is very jarring, as it was when the game came out and everybody was like, what the fuck? You know?
Yeah. When we, I watched it with my wife and her dad was visiting and we were all watching it. And there's that like cliffhanger in episode, I think 6 of season 1, where Joel gets stabbed and then he falls off the horse. The episode just ends right there. My wife and her dad, both while we're watching, was just like, I got to look up if he dies. And they just looked it up on Google and they're like, well, I found out he dies, but he doesn't die from that. So when we were watching, she knew he would die, but she did not know the means. I did not give her any details. So she was still very upset at how it went down because it's a very grotesque and brutal death scene.
Yeah,
it is brutal. And a lot of people are arguing over whether or not the game was more brutal or the show, like in how he dies.
Definitely the game. They didn't show a lot in the show.
I think it was, I don't know, it was brutal in different ways for me. Like I actually think the like cinematography and the performances are much better, as well as the editing in the game, with that scene specifically. But I do think the like show has a much more like emotional brutality to it. I don't know.
I actually think the scene in the hospital with Ellie was pretty good in this episode that just happened. Like I think her like reaction to everything was actually pretty good. And I think that had we got something similar to that in the episode where he actually died, I would have been a lot more sold on the scene.
Are you talking about like the PTSD moment where she feels like she's still in the room with it happening? Or
Yeah.
And then, also the therapist conversation with Catherine O'Hara, I thought was really great. She's been such a great inclusion into this season. I think she's been doing really, she always does
a really
good
job. Yeah, it's a really,
really
cool original character they added.
Oh, she's not in the game.
No, she's not in the game at all. There's no
oh, okay.
There's no time for therapy in games. We got to kill clickers.
You guys told me that. Yeah, but so let's talk about the Pedro Pascal industrial complex for a second. Like, is the Pedro bubble going to burst soon? Like, how long can this guy stay on top of Hollywood and be like the hottest actor ever, you know?
I mean, adore him. I really do. But all women do. It's just a woman thing. I know. I feel like he's in everything and he's like the guy, which is interesting because he's like older and he's been around since like Game of Thrones, like, and even before that.
He was in Buffy.
Know? Oh my god, I forgot.
Yeah, he plays a vampire in Buffy.
Wow, I may have to revisit that. Yeah, I don't know. I think like, but I also feel like it's just like, I was telling this to my boyfriend the other day. Like, I'm like, I feel like it's just like a running meme that he dies in everything that he's in. I'm like, I want him to stay alive in something. I feel like he's always just dying constantly. It's very frustrating.
Maybe we'll finally get him off in the complex. Mandalorian movie.
Yeah, he's like the new Sean Bean. He's like always dying and shit.
I like him a lot. I definitely, the bubble has burst for me. I've complained about him previously on the podcast. I just feel like he's being thrown into everything and I'm just like,
you're not a fan of his like fantastic forecasting, right?
Not really. I mean, I might be proven wrong, but I've never seen him play smart and I don't really see him playing smart.
Well, the Red Viper of Doran is very smart. He's very cunning. He's good with the politics, you know, the politics.
His whole thing
world.
Is he's like just cocky as fuck.
Yeah, but yeah, that's what's his undoing. But I'm just saying, like he's an operator in the Game of Thrones. You know, like he's not passive.
Reed Richards is literally, of all the humans in the Marvel universe, Reed Richards is the smartest person.
Yeah. From what I've seen in the trailer, he seems like he pulls it off well. Like that line about he's like, I stretch the bounds of space and time and something called back from the abyss or like something like that. And I was like, well, that's a really cool line. I'm actually very pumped
I'm willing to give him a shot. I'm not going to just write him off, but he wouldn't have been my first choice is all I'm kind of saying there.
Yeah, I think he was very much like a break glass in case of emergency Marvel choice. And I say that as someone who adores him. And this is someone who like I am tuned out of Marvel at this point now. Like I can't tell you the last one that I like saw in theaters. My boyfriend goes and he keeps me up to date on what's going on there. But like that's, you know, that's the one that I'm going to go back to see, I guess, because I'm like, I like him. Like the marketing worked on me. Actually, when that news first came out that he was playing Reed Richards, I told this on a live stream recently, actually. I did make a video about it, like just talking about the news. It's not on my channel anymore. It is unlisted. And the reason for that is because I put Pedro Pascal in the title of the video and I accidentally left the R out of his first name. So it said Pedro Pascal. And then I went back to work. I went back to work and was not looking at my YouTube channel because I was working. And then everybody was trying to get my attention about the typo and they were spamming pedo in the comments. And because of that, the video got like shadow banned by YouTube because it was just absolutely fucking tanking and I had to take it down.
Oh my God. That's funny.
That's my fun Pedro Pascal Reed Richards
thanks
anecdote.
Thanks a lot, Pedro.
Jeez.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Pedro, for having that name. But yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic, but it's just because like I'm a fan of him.
That's one of the best typo stories I've ever heard. That rules.
Literally,
I'm
just
sure
so.
Right now, but.
So I can laugh at it now because it's so ridiculous. It's like, and it's proof that like YouTube does shadow ban because I mean like tanking, and no wonder because everybody was like Pedro Pascal in the comments like Kayla fucking fix this, and I was like fuck what happened.
Jesus.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I think it might be fair to say though that like the moment that Pedro Pascal's been having for the past 4 or 5 years can rival almost any A-list like male leading man that I can even really think of. You know, maybe not like, you know, going back to Marlon Brando or something. Just talking about like not necessarily acting chops, but the consistency of getting really high profile roles back to back to back.
I think you're forgetting my man The Rock.
Well,
that's a little different.
I don't know. Like, you could say Leo, I guess. You could say Brad Pitt, but like, I don't know. Pedro seems like he's working so much more frequently than those guys ever did.
Well,
I think also
he didn't really hit his stardom until like in his like mid to late 40s. Like Pedro, it wasn't until like I'd say Mandalorian kind of like was the, or I guess Game of Thrones, but then after Mandalorian, it was like every year he was in something. Everyone's like, oh, this guy's awesome. And then he was Joel. And just from there on, it's just been this like building snowball.
That Nick Cage movie.
Yeah. He was in, the Massive Way to Unbearable Talent.
Yeah. Yeah. He's just,
he's like relatable tier, I think. Like I just feel like people just, they're like, oh, he's like a cool guy. And like, doesn't even really often have that much to do with his acting. I don't like, he's not like, I love him. I don't think he's the best actor that I've ever seen. You know what I mean? Like, I think he's given some good performances in like what I have seen him in. But a lot of times it's like, you know, people like him because he's just like a fun, chill guy. Like, and he appeals to multiple demographic groups.
Yeah.
Women love him. The gays love him. Like he's just that guy.
Gruff dudes love him. They're like, yeah, I'd be like Joel. If I was the end of the zombie apocalypse.
it is kind of like perfect timing for, if you think about like getting killed off of The Last of Us for him, because, you know, I'm sure he was happy to be a part of The Last of Us, but in an actor in his position, like being as in demand as he is now, he's even more in demand now than he was at the time when he booked that role. So I'm sure he's like, I got that. I did that. Now I can move on. He doesn't have to be connected to a Game of Thrones scale production on HBO for the foreseeable future, like someone like Jon Snow or Emilia Clarke was. Kit Harington. I didn't mean to say his name is actually Jon Snow, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean it's. Are you guys Severance people?
Mm-hmm.
Are you into
Severance?
Yeah, I just finished
Severance.
So it's like, you know, like Jon Turturro at the end of season 2. I feel like they're almost like writing his character like almost out. Like I don't know if they're doing that for sure. But it's like, I wouldn't be surprised because it's like, he's fucking Jon Turturro. He can do whatever he wants. Does he want to be like a reoccurring, like, you know, cast member for however many seasons they do the show? I don't know if he does. He's like a big name. You know what I mean? It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah,
like.
He didn't even come back to play Carmine Falcone and like the Penguin. He was just like, nah, I'm good.
Oh, yeah.
Do y'all have any like actors who had a big breakout that never really popped off that you kind of wish did?
Emile Hirsch.
Emile Hirsch is a good one.
Remember him?
Like, he's Emile Hirsch.
Emile Hirsch, he was a really big deal like back in the late 2000s. He was in a lot of like kind of like indie
Heath
darling.
Ledger-ish,
yeah,
actor.
Yeah. And then he kind of didn't really go much of anywhere, but I miss him. I miss seeing him and stuff all the time.
Mine is Andrew Lincoln. I feel like he sat in The Walking Dead for long, but he's so good. He's such a good actor.
He's really talented.
And he also plays the biggest creep in the history of the world, history of cinema in that movie.
The rom-com?
Yeah, the rom-com that like everybody's in and he's like with Keira Knightley. Do you know what I'm talking about? What is that movie called?
I forgot what it's called. Here, I'll find it.
But he falls in love with his best friend's wife and he's just like creepily basically stalking her, but it's portrayed as romantic.
Love Actually.
That's
what Love Actually.
Yeah.
I don't understand the hype behind Love Actually. I watched it and I felt worse as a person.
My answer to your question, I don't know if this really counts. I thought Aaron Paul would have had a bigger career post Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
And I love him in BoJack, and like he was cool in that one Black Mirror episode. I just think like he would have been everywhere. And I'm just kind of surprised he wasn't.
He was in a few things that bombed though. Like he was in they like kind of panic casted him in
Need for Speed.
Westworld and Need for Speed.
Oh yeah.
He was just in too many bombs, I think. I think he's a good actor though.
Yeah,
and he's kind of the voice acting thing seems to be a something he's doing more often because now it's he's voicing someone like seems to be a recurring character on Invincible. So,
he is an Invincible.
Electric Man or whatever.
Yeah,
yeah.
But I mean, I feel like you want to start wrapping up here. I mean, you guys have any final thoughts, concerns, comments?
No, I really appreciate you hopping on. It was really fun.
thanks Kayla. This was a good app.
Thank you so much Kayla. This was really fun.
This was great. I hope that was like a good podcast guest.
Oh, you're great.
You were.
No worries. You're great.
It was awesome.
Appreciate it. Awesome.
All right, well, what are we doing now? Next week
I think it's my rec.
We have a director hopping on.
Oh,
so let me find his social media link so people can check him out real quick.
Yeah, so we're going to be talking about his films.
If anybody wants to look up Gare_Scare on Instagram, he has his movies produced through Troma. I don't know if y'all heard of Troma. Like they've been like the Toxic Avenger, things like that.
Yeah, that was with James Gunn's old career.
Yeah, so we're going to go through some of his movies. He sent me a couple links to some of his movies that I don't know if maybe he'll share them to everybody else who listens then or maybe not. I'm not sure, but we're going to sit down with him.
Cool.
Awesome.
Well, that'll be exciting. Thank you guys all for watching. If you want to... Actually, I can't tell you. I don't know what the deal with the movie is, but we're going to be talking about Gare Scare next episode. if you're listening to this or watching this on YouTube, please leave us a like. Comment.
He actually sent me an email with the intro to the film. Let me pull this up real quick. I'll read it off for us.
Okay. Read it off for us.
All right. So he said... So his first movie is called Good People or Bad People Doing Bad Things from 2021. And his other one is called Hishkenstein After Dark from 2024. And he basically said, both of my films featuring our character Ramirez Hishkenstein, the racially ambiguous director who self-describes himself as an extraordinary method filmmaker, occultist, and erotic provocateur. It's fun, repulsive, gross, freakish, horrifying, hilarious, stupid, and weird. So... he reached out to me actually because of my video, Movies Aren't Fun Anymore. And he was just basically saying, I agree, movies aren't really fun anymore. So here's some movies that I think are fun.
Yeah, awesome.
Well, cool. Yeah. Well, if you don't want to be spoiled for that, if those are available, are those just available on like Prime?
If they are, I'll run them by them. If so, we can throw them out on our social media so people can give them a watch.
All right, cool. Well, we can't wait to talk to him. But as I was saying, if you listen to this on YouTube or watching it, please leave us a like and comment. Same goes for our audio listening platforms such as Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Leaving us ratings and commenting on our posts over there really helps out the algorithm, because the algorithm is the death of everything that goes online. So we need your help. Thank you once again, Kayla, for being on here. We really appreciate it. Thanks for
of course.
Taking a chance on a little pod like us.
Yeah, you guys are
really
great.
Really means a lot. Kayla says.
Yeah, check out Kayla's. Please do. Kayla, do you want to plug yourself to anyone listening?
You can check me out on YouTube at Kayla Says. I post videos every week about pop culture topics. I am also on Twitter at Kayla Says More. I am on Instagram at Kayla_Rosa. I have link trees in all of my socials, so you can catch me anywhere. I'm on Letterboxd. I'm anywhere on the internet that you need me to be. So come hang out. It's a good time.
And we end the podcast by saying get Stuckmanized. So.
Oh, yeah, real quick. What's your... real quick. We got to actually forgot to mention that. How do you feel about our patron saint, Chris Stuckman?
Chris is... That's really fucking funny. I'm sorry. Listen, Chris is an old school YouTuber, and he's got a movie coming out, and good for him.
Yeah.
Get Stuckmanized.
We're going to talk about it.
Get Stuckmanized. We'll get him on the pod one day.
That's hilarious. All right.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.